Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Scott Seaman, and this is Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This episode actually is originating from New York, and it's a special broadcast of Insurance Law Radio because we are participating in a meeting of the Intermediaries and Reinsurance Underwriters Association, IRUA. And the IRUA is a not-for-profit corporation founded in 1967. Its members include property and casualty reinsurers, ceding companies, and reinsurance intermediaries. And it's focused on promoting professionalism and educational advancement in the industry. And they do that through reinsurance educational programming, publications, and networking opportunities. And I have to say the IRUA has a very august membership, and I'm staring out at several of those members here today. And a couple we have to acknowledge, Sylvia Kaminsky, who helped put this thing together, and those of us who are engaged in reinsurance arbitrations know her, among other skills, to be a fabulous panel member, serving both as a party appointed and as an umpire. And also we have to thank Jerry Wallace, who's the executive director of IRUA. So with that, let me just introduce our subject for today, which is reinsurance arbitrations and effective arbitration clauses. Arbitration, as opposed to litigation, historically has been the method of choice for resolution of reinsurance disputes. Most treaties and many facultative certificates contain provisions that require the disputes between the ceding company and the reinsurer be submitted to arbitration for resolution. Arbitration, at least historically, had the perception of providing an effective and efficient means of resolving commercial disputes between parties in an off-the-record, at least a confidential, private setting where the parties could submit their disputes to panels of industry experts who rendered decisions not only guided by the law but by their understanding of reinsurance custom and practice. One court observed that disputes between ceding companies and reinsurers have often been settled by handshakes and umpires. Now, in recent years, and this will come as no surprise to anybody around the table, there's been a growing wave of expressions of dissatisfaction with the arbitration process. And I have to say, those of us who also litigate experience the same thing on that side, and I think the message may be that the grass is always greener in the forum that you're not litigating in. But in essence, a lot of parties, some lawyers, some panel members, feel that we can do a better job as an industry in achieving cost-effective, fair results and improve things, and a lot of efforts. It's a continuous process, really. So some of the complaints include the difficulty in selecting an impartial neutral or umpire, the lack of binding precedent, the potential for compromised decisions, the non-availability or the limited availability of discovery and extraordinary remedies, the limited scope of substantive review of panel decisions, the absence of compulsory process to make witnesses appear, the extensive cost of discovery, gamesmanship, the time, but the tension between the application of strict rules of law or legal rules versus custom and practice, has, I think, heightened itself in more recent years because you have a lot of seating companies, for example, who in resolving their disputes, whether it's in coverage litigation or just by settlement with their policyholders, are bound by legal principles. And then sometimes when those disputes are transported into a reinsurance arbitration, there's a feeling by some seating companies that maybe panels don't fully appreciate it. Now, all of these complaints, or many of them, are some of the same reasons the parties choose to arbitrate a lot of their disputes. So there are, and there's also some contradictions in some, among some of these complaints. Not enough discovery, too much discovery. And some of that is just what we always see as a part of parties being subject to disputes and not always liking the results or even the process. Some parties have decided to no longer include arbitration clauses in their contracts, but I think the number of parties who are doing that are very limited. I do think that ceding companies and reinsurers are going to continue to use arbitration, use it as the main mode of dispute resolution, and there's not going to be any abandoning en masse of arbitrations. But what the parties are doing is paying a lot more attention to the contract, the arbitration clause, some related provisions at the time of drafting and entering into the contract. And what I tell my clients a lot of times is that there are several things that parties can do to make the arbitration experience better in terms of results and efficiency and cost. The first one is to hire good lawyers, because I think that makes a difference. The second is to look inward a little bit, because there are times when company representatives can do a better job in steering and managing the process. The third thing is pick quality panel members, because no matter how much you try to draft into a contract, you're not going to think of everything, and it ultimately boils down to the quality of the decision makers. And then the fourth thing is to think about it at the time that you're drafting and negotiating your reinsurance contracts, and cogently craft arbitration provisions, because I think a lot of times people with arbitration clauses, as with many other clauses in both fact certs and treaties, just sort of cut and paste, often blindly, provisions that they've used before. The parties do have very broad control over the arbitration process because they can craft the arbitration clause. They can craft the contract language in a manner that suits their needs. And that litigants don't usually enjoy that same privilege. As with reinsurance contract drafting in general, there are issues about how specific you want to be, because you have to have the flexibility as parties, and the panel has to have the flexibility to resolve disputes based on the facts, the circumstances, the amount and controversy, and the types of things that make panel members do what they do and parties advocate what they advocate. And I think if you try and cut too sharp a line on provisions in an arbitration clause, you wind up in disputes that aren't the types of disputes you may have envisioned, and you've tied hands of people unnecessarily. And Ed's going to talk about that. The one other point I did want to make is that while there's broad latitude in a party's ability to draft the reinsurance arbitration process, it's not without limits. And we're all aware of the United States Supreme Court case in Hall Street Associates, and that reminds us that parties, that the Federal Arbitration Act has limited grounds to vacate an arbitration award, and the parties cannot expand those grounds by agreement. But we also know that the Federal Arbitration Act is not the only game in town, and parties are free to select other laws to govern. There are several state arbitration acts that do permit the parties to expand the scope of vacating a review of awards, or that have more grounds than the FAA. And of course, with manifest disregard of the law no longer a basis in many circuits, that among parties is an issue that they're focusing on in terms of saying what they want to do. And when I was in law school, the law professors used to say that federal judges had the most power of anybody in your life. They have lifetime tenure. And I understand that, and they are powerful people when you're in front of them, to be sure. But panel members, I think, are more powerful because they exercise that full reign of authority with respect to that arbitration, unless limited by the contract, and the grounds by which you can appeal them are much, much more limited. So it is an awesome responsibility that panel members have, and they generally take that very seriously. So let's get into the subject of arbitration clauses. And joining us on this broadcast is Edward Lindsay. Ed is a partner of Hinshaw & Culbertson, operating out of our New York office. He handles complex business litigation and arbitrations, including international arbitrations, as well as reinsurance disputes, class action defense, and appeals. If I read everything that Ed wrote, we'd be here for an extra half hour. But I'm just going to say that his successes include a class action defense victory before the United States Supreme Court. So we're going to be discussing various elements commonly contained in arbitration provisions, and also some provisions that maybe ought to be in there, sometimes that are not. So Ed, thank you very much for joining us. And before we get into some of the specifics, do you have some general overall drafting tips for parties?
I do, and thank you, Scott. Thank you very much for those kind words. Welcome, everybody. Welcome here to Hinshaw's New York office. Let me begin by saying that a big part of the current problem is that arbitration has been the norm in the reinsurance business for so long that all too often the parties negotiate a reinsurance contract and don't give much thought to the dispute resolution clause. And what they're doing oftentimes is using off-the-rack arbitration provisions that may have been drafted back in the 1970s, which were a very...
Life was better then.
Did you say the 1790s?
Close, the 1970s, which was a very different world in terms of dispute resolution. What I'm advocating is that arbitration agreements need to be drafted to fit the current needs of current realities, such as e-discovery. And they need to be flexible so that those realities of the future can be addressed in years to come, realities that may not be anticipated at the present time. That doesn't mean that the off-the-rack provisions aren't the right ones. It just means that such provisions should be selected if, but only if, they are the right ones for the parties who are drafting this particular reinsurance agreement. So in terms of drafting, I want to give the 30,000-foot view before we get into specifics. And as I see it, there are three basic rules of effective contract drafting, and that includes, in particular, dispute resolution clauses. And the first rule comes out of a Kipling poem, where Kipling wrote, I keep six honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when, and how and where and who. And these, of course, are the five W's and H that we were all taught in grammar school in terms of asking the right questions. And these questions should be asked by parties when they are drafting dispute resolution provisions, such as arbitration clauses.
And by the way, that just shows you Ed's acumen, that he would draw upon a famous poet, because I would have gone with Abbott and Costello.
So, who, what, when, where, how, and why? The who, this refers to the qualifications and backgrounds of the arbitrator or arbitrators that will hear the dispute and decide it. In litigation, of course, the who is the judge, and the parties have no control over who their judge will be if they go that route, other than to select a particular forum, but the judge will usually be always be picked for you. The what. The what is what to arbitrate. Do you arbitrate all issues, some issues? This is an important consideration that parties have to give at the outset because it can make a big difference in the outcome of different disputes, whether it's heard by an arbitration panel or by a court. The when in the arbitration context has a number of considerations. It can include well-thought-out scheduling parameters that achieve a prompt resolution without hobbling the process from the outset with unrealistically tight schedules. In other words, a schedule that allows the parties to make haste slowly. The when can also include prerequisites to arbitration, such as requiring that the parties mediate their dispute first. As far as where, the location of the arbitration is the where. Consideration needs to be given to the location of the parties and potential witnesses, but parties need to understand that that can change over time, particularly after this era of insurer and reinsurer consolidations. How? In arbitration, the how focuses on the procedures and logistics of the arbitration itself and the discovery that precedes the hearing. In litigation, the how, of course, is determined by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, over which the parties have no control. And then finally, the why. That gets to the issue that Scott was talking about in the introduction. Why arbitrate? Why not litigate? This is a question that the parties should ask themselves at the outset, because it can have a big make a big difference in the outcome, and it can make a big difference in how the case proceeds. The parties want to achieve their intent, not somebody else's intent, and so all these questions are questions that the parties have to ask at the outset, instead of just taking those off-the-rack provisions and cut and pasting, as Scott said, into the reinsurance agreement. The next rule is well known by the acronym KISS. Keep it straightforward and simple. I've seen arbitration clauses drafted that are multi-paragraph long, and they're very confusing to deal with. And the more arbitration clause gets built up like that, the greater the likelihood that the a dispute over arbitrability or over the powers of the arbitration panel is going to wind up in court. Everything I'm saying here is good for the parties.
You have one more pointer?
Yeah. One more point of the three basic rules, and this is use plain language, not legalese, language that everybody can understand. Again, it's a situation where if you incorporate legalese into any kind of agreement, particularly a dispute resolution agreement, you're bound to wind up in court because one party or the other will question what it actually means, and it becomes a field day for the parties to delay things.
But thanks to spell check, you can use more complicated words now. So Ed, let's talk. You alluded to the threshold issue of arbitrability, whether a particular dispute is subject to the arbitration clause or not, and that depends on the scope of the arbitration clause itself. Could you provide us with a very quick overview of the scope of some traditional reinsurance contract arbitration clauses?
Sure. Let me begin by letting you know that with the materials that are in front of you is Chapter 6 of the Reinsurance Desk Book, which was written by Scott. And at pages 107 and 118 of that handout, there are model arbitration provisions. And these are very good templates that the parties can use, again, keeping in mind to select the one that is right for the parties and what they anticipate in their dispute. But these are some traditional reinsurance contract arbitration provisions that have stood the test of time. One of the fundamental decisions concerns whether to use a narrow or a broad arbitration clause. And a narrow arbitration clause would limit the number of disputes that go to the arbitration panel, and the disputes that are outside the scope of that would be subject to litigation. So parties have to give special thought to how broad or how narrow they make it, an arbitration provision at the time they enter into the contract. And one example of this is from the Gerling Global Reinsurance versus ACE case, which was heard in the Second Circuit back in 2002. And there the Second Circuit held that a clause requiring arbitration of an, quote, irreconcilable difference of opinion as to the scope of this certificate, that's a narrow clause which did not encompass a reinsurer's claim for rescission. And the court observed that reinsurance, the resolution of such a claim would depend on what the cedent knew and when it knew it, and not on the interpretation of any provisions of the contract. So there is an example of a narrow arbitration clause.
So can you tell us a trend or two that we're seeing in terms of scope of arbitrability and arbitration clauses?
Yeah, one trend is to have smaller disputes handled differently. And one of the ways this is being done is through Arias US, which is well known to everybody in this room, so I don't need to go into details about Arias. But we're seeing more use of the Arias streamline rules for small claims disputes. This, of course, is something that the parties can, if they choose, incorporate into arbitration agreements now. and utilize them in the future. Another trend is folks are looking for neutral panels as opposed to the traditional panel where you have two party-appointed arbitrators who are oftentimes advocates for the party, and an umpire who's supposed to be neutral, but given the way selection processes work, oftentimes is not, or at least has a predetermined view about one party or the other. So there's a greater move in the industry now looking at neutral panels, and the again, Arias has adopted neutral panel rules for the resolution of U.S. insurance and reinsurance disputes. They involve a very detailed selection process for the panel, which is intended to try to ensure that the arbitrators who hear the dispute are truly neutral, all three of them, and that the dispute will be resolved on the merits instead of by the coin toss.
And why would parties, if you want to have three neutral arbitrators, why would parties have a panel of three as opposed to just one?
Well, the thinking is that three heads are better than one, and that particularly where the issue is going to be decided based upon the custom and practice of the industry, having three is viewed as ensuring that it'll really be the custom and practice of the industry as opposed to the custom and practice according to one person.
Ed, could you, arbitration clauses are very light typically on what they say about institution of an arbitration and responding. Briefly, what's the general practice in reinsurance agreements?
In reinsurance agreements, the initiation of arbitration is usually a very straightforward affair. In my experience, it's a simple letter which covers the names of the parties, the contract, and the nature of the dispute. And if it's done right, the demand for arbitration can be a one-page document. Some people opt to use more detailed arbitration provisions. That's their option, but the typical practice is to go with the short and sweet letter.
Yeah, I mean, the two things I would add is obviously you want to comply with the time deadlines for appointing, and that a Seventh Circuit case from a few years ago reminds us that unlike the federal rules of civil procedure, when you're in arbitration, holidays and weekends count. So unless your contracts exempt that, and if you want them to, you want to make that express, but otherwise you're subject to a strict calendar count.
Yeah, that becomes particularly important for the respondent because many arbitration clauses provide that once the demand for arbitration is received by the responding party, the responding party has a set number of days to appoint its party-appointed arbitrator, and that is a requirement that is typically strictly enforced, and a party that fails to appoint its arbitrator within the time provided in the rule will likely have his or her arbitrator appointed by the other side.
What are your thoughts? You had mentioned earlier, and a lot of times parties will accomplish either with respect to procedure, with respect to timing, with respect to discovery, which we'll talk about later on, with respect to composition of panel, rather than dealing with it in large part or devoting a lot of language to it, simply incorporate a set of rules. And parties are free to do whatever they want in that respect, whether it's ARIAS, a particular ARIAS set of rules, whether it's AAA, whether it's the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, whatever they want to incorporate. But I see a lot of parties get frustrated sometimes when they thought they did it, but they didn't do it correctly, or where they refer to a set of rules which have been amended multiple times since. So what would you suggest to parties? Or one other thing, or arbitrate before a body that no longer exists at the time of a dispute.
I had that come up actually in a consumer arbitration some years ago where the National Arbitration Forum was the named forum in the arbitration provision and it no longer existed. Fortunately, we didn't have to resolve that issue immediately because there was another issue that came up, but that is a problem. Organizations such as AAA, JAMS, CPR, they provide preset rules, but to incorporate them into an arbitration provision now runs the risk that, the unlikely risk, but a risk that 15 years from now, when a dispute comes up, that the organization won't exist anymore, or will exist in a radically different form than it was at the time the parties entered the agreement.
And of course, parties can do some stuff about that. So you can say, if you're looking at the set of rules before you, and that's what you want, you could say the Arias rules effective, blah, 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 whether or not they're in effect at the time of the dispute. You can, if you want it to be updated, the rules then in effect. But a lot of, especially in treaty relationships, I'm seeing parties focusing more on dealing with that by way of a rider and maybe agreeing, you know, to revisit the dispute resolution rules, you know, every year or every 3 years or every renewal to keep it updated that way.
You're listening to Hinshawn Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Let's return to the program and your host, Scott Seaman.
So let's talk a little bit more about composition of the panel, because it's obviously important. And if you look, there's been a lot of disputes over the years over issues relating to the panel. But traditionally, U.S. reinsurance arbitration, it is the panel of three with a party-appointed arbitrator representing each of the parties and having an ability to be a panel member, yet party can have ex-party communications, and a party-appointed can do more advocacy than a neutral could do, typically. Now you get into it, obviously it depends on a lot more circumstances than that. But talk about the traditional composition and a little bit more about some of the motivations for a neutral and how you think that's working out.
Well, there are, as you said, traditionally in arbitration, reinsurance arbitration, the arbitration provisions have required that the arbitrators be officers or directors of insurance or reinsurance companies, active, former, and or retired. There has been litigation over the meaning of active, forward, and retired, so it's important to be aware of that when you're drafting an arbitration clause. Do you want somebody who used to work in the industry only, or do you want somebody who's currently? You got to think about that at the time of drafting. But particularly now with the push toward neutrality, that's harder to achieve where you have the traditional system. And so, in addition to the neutral rules we talked about earlier, one option, and again, parties have complete control over their arbitration, almost complete control, I should say, but definitely in the way of panel selection.
Not when it starts. Not after it starts.
But definitely in the way of panel selection. And one item I've heard discussed is to still retain the party-appointed arbitrator aspects of the tripartite panel, but include a judge, a former judge, as perhaps the umpire. And one of the advantages I can think of doing that is that a judge is going to probably have more experience controlling the process. The disadvantage is that the judge is not going to have the depth of knowledge of the industry that the two party appointeds have, but presumably the party appointeds can educate the judge in the process in addition to the party's briefs so that the former judge can function.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, you know, there are several umpires that have hundreds of arbitrations under their belt and have as much seasoning as a federal judge when it comes to handling proceedings and the proceedings that presumably the party want them to handle. And now in today's arbitration, very rarely do you see a non-lawyer. I think sometimes it's more of, well, the other side's probably going to get a lawyer, the umpire might be a lawyer, I'm disadvantaged if I don't have one. And a lot of today's disputes are more involve legal issues as opposed to business ones. How can the parties effectively deal with it? Because when you're dealing with a business dispute and you have business issues, parties really are better off by having people that have that industry experience, whether or not they're lawyers or not. Maybe that was redundant.
And that was the original, I think the original intent when those clauses were drafted back in the 60s and 70s, which as I said, were a different era in dispute resolution. The hope was that that arbitration would be a simple, straightforward affair, very inexpensive, very straightforward, and that somebody who was active in the business and knew the custom and practices, or retired from the business but remembered the customs and practices, that those people would hear the dispute. But you know, nowadays, it's really because the process has gotten so expensive and has taken on many of the aspects of litigation that there have been folks proposing ways in which the process can be improved, including the selection of neutral panels under the Arias rule, for example.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about two more panel member issues. The first is panel selection. I read so many of these contracts that say that, you know, parties will appoint, and if the two-party appointed can't agree, then the umpire shall be selected by drawing lots. I'm a painter. I'm not a drawer. What does that mean? And practically, in most certificates and treaties, what's the process for selecting the umpire?
It's a fairly straightforward process. Each side proposes three umpire candidates, perhaps more, but typically the arbitration provision says three. And then the other side strikes two from that list, and then there's a coin toss. And the coin toss, the one I'm most experienced with, is selecting the last digit of the Dow, Jones Industrial Average for a particular day. If it's odd, one side picks the umpire. If it's even, the other side picks the umpire.
Yeah, and that's most of the traditional contract guidance. But we see a lot of parties, when they get right down to it, saying, well, that, you know, that's all well and good, but the hell with the Dow. Can't we work off of a list, and each side picks so many, and the other side strikes so many, and then we're left with somebody, or you have whatever auspices you're arbitrating before, JAMS or AAA, submit a list to you, and you strike. What about those processes?
Well, I experienced one several years ago, and it worked out very nicely. The arbitration provision had the traditional language about striking two and then tossing a coin as to the remaining two candidates. And the other side proposed to me that we do something a little more sophisticated, which was each side propose six, and then those be ranked. And as a result of that, we came out with a pretty good umpire for the case. The case actually ended up getting resolved because I think both sides realized that the umpire was a fair person and a person who was going to see both sides of it. And therefore, it wasn't a situation where the arbitration was prolonged because it was a perception that the umpire candidate had been, was just another party appointed for the other side. It worked out very nicely.
So we have lots of battles over the qualifications of panel members. Sometimes it's out of the box before there's any partial, final, or any type of award. Generally, you can't appeal those. You've got to wait to the end. But typically, most contracts say very little about the qualifications. They may say, you know, executive officer, director. They may have words like disinterested in it. There's concepts in the FAA of evident impartiality, but it mostly, in my experience, comes down to disclosures, and people request disclosures. I think panel members do their best to come up with them. It's a crazy world and hard to track everything, but what at the contracting time can the parties do to be more express, if anything, about qualifications?
Well, they certainly can control the process at the drafting stage by just being more explicit about what the qualifications of the panelists who will hear that dispute be. Again, the challenge with that is that if one party or the other decides not to adhere and proposes somebody who maybe doesn't fit those qualifications, it's going to end up in court afterwards, but not during the course of the arbitration when it would really count. But I've seen arbitration clauses where, for example, the parties have agreed to a process where they will try to ascertain what the issue is, and the panelists would have to be experienced somehow or other in that particular issue.
What about, I've had it happen a few times where a panel member withdraws for various reasons. Usually it's worked out okay, the parties agreed upon something, or it was early enough in the process. But there was at least a one time where things were very far along and there was no agreement as to how to proceed. Is that issue addressed? Are parties addressing that at all in the time of drafting?
Typically, no. Most arbitration clauses, in fact, very few, have a provision concerning what to do in the event an arbitrator drops out for whatever reason. So typically, those issues end up in court, where the court is dealing with it, unless something gets worked out between the parties. But again, that doesn't mean that the parties can't do that. And one of the reasons I advocate serious thought about an arbitration provision instead of using off-the-rack arbitration provisions is that at the drafting stage, parties can take care of that eventuality with a properly drafted arbitration clause, a properly drafted clause.
Traditionally, clauses really haven't addressed discovery at all, except perhaps if they adopt or refer to a particular set of rules or procedures. But many companies, on the one hand, major concerns about the cost and efficiency and burden of the process because of discovery. Judges hate discovery. Panel members hate discovery. Lawyers, for some reason, tend to like it. Hey, we didn't say we were going to break any news here. But what are parties doing about that now?
Well, the big change in discovery, of course, as everyone knows, is the e-discovery. And that's become a very complicated issue to deal with. And it's particularly complicated in arbitration because, again, the arbitration provisions were drafted long ago before there was even e-discovery. And they don't say anything about it.
There's a lot of people, not only in the reinsurance community, but in the world, and even some in the political world, that wish there were no such thing as e-discovery. But, I mean, it is here to stay. And my estimation is 4 out of 5 times more discovery is sought than is needed. Yet, there is that occasional case where the arbitration actually is and actually ought to be more like a litigation because of the amount in controversy and because of the issues that are involved, that you really do need full-blown discovery. And how do you deal with this notion of, again, not one size fits all and arbitrary rules on numbers of depths and time for discovery? If you put them in the contract up front, you may wish you hadn't when you get to arbitration.
Well, what that really gets to is the issue of proportionality. And that's now incorporated into the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, so that there is not a one-size-fits-all approach to discovery. And I've seen talk about, I've heard talk, rather, about drafting arbitration provisions that parallel the new rules in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I took a crack at that and drafted a provision here based upon Rule 26B1, dealing with proportionality, and it's simply the notion that discovery shall be strictly limited to any non-privileged matter that's both relevant to a claim or defense and proportional to the needs of the arbitration. So if it's $1 million arbitration or even less, the discovery in the case should be tailored accordingly such that you're not running up $500,000 in e-discovery costs over a dispute that's only worth $1 million. But this is just one suggestion. There are variations on this. I've seen them. But I think the parties nowadays, and particularly with the guidance of the federal rules, need to give serious consideration to including at the drafting stage a proportionality provision such that in the arbitration, discovery doesn't get out of hand. Now, part of the challenge is that, of course, if the arbitrators decide not to follow that provision, what do? You'd have to wait until the end of the arbitration. But putting it in the provision now, I think arbitrators take their job very seriously. And if there's a provision in the arbitration agreement that says that discovery shall be proportional to the dispute, there's a pretty good chance that the really good arbitrators, and there are a lot of them out there, will take that seriously and will limit discovery accordingly.
Yeah, and I sort of come back to, go ahead, you have a question?
Will we take questions now? Or
you know what, at the end, we'll pass the microphone on. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the best part of the program will be when we get the comments and insights and questions of our panel members, so we're not going to cut that short. But let me just say that, again, there's so much you can do in drafting, but when you try and draft too much, a lot of times the solution is a good panel, because I would venture to say there's very few panelists that know that they need to see the word proportionality in a contract in order to, you know, recognize that the amount of discovery that they're going to allow is tied to how much is in dispute. What I find happens a lot of times is you'll have a pretty perfunctory organizational meeting, and the briefs are, the submissions are pretty vanilla, the meeting's pretty vanilla, schedule gets set, and then the parties go crazy, or one party goes crazy with discovery. And, you know, the better panels will, once they see this flying, they'll invite the party either through status reports or if it becomes an issue to raise it, and then they'll learn what they need to know about a particular dispute to make provide some guidance on discovery. So the only other thing I would like to touch on relating to this is confidentiality, and parties are paying a lot more attention to confidentiality and putting express confidentiality provisions in their contracts, usually not even tied to the arbitration clause. You know, it's always been the custom and practice that arbitration proceedings are confidential. It's usually taken care of in a confidentiality order at the organizational meeting. But a lot of parties now are concerned about it to the point where they're putting that in their contract, because not only for reasons of the arbitration, but policyholders are becoming and have become very aggressive in underlying coverage litigation and seeking discovery. And it also ties into, you know, the inspection clauses, where parties want to have that ironed out in advance. So you have rights of inspection that may be tied to arbitration but are independent of it because of the contract provision. And one of our august members asked, even without a discovery clause like the one you put up there, doesn't the panel have the power to use that standard?
Oh, absolutely. The panel has the power to do so. My the intent here is to remind, you know, to demonstrate the party's intent at the outset that the dispute should be proportional, because though the panel has the power to do it, one party or the other seeking to really blow discovery out of control may end up wasting a lot of time arguing for that position and propounding discovery that is just overly broad, requiring that the parties go to the panel to get the discovery dispute resolved. A provision like this, by demonstrating the party's intent at the outset, would you know, be something that would allow the panel to more clearly and at the beginning define the limits of discovery in accordance with the party's intent.
And that's actually a good segue to the next subject, which would be remedies and power of the panel. Typically, you don't have a lot of language in arbitration agreements about addressing the power of the panel and what they may award. Sometimes you do. Sometimes panels may garner it from an honorable engagement clause. But parties are getting more specific with respect to awards of attorney's fees, interest. I remember a couple years ago we had a nice discussion in a group about punitive damages. What are parties considering regarding those issues?
Well, parties are taking the issue of attorney's fees and punitive damages and interest more seriously nowadays. In the past, occasionally arbitration provisions dealt with that. They didn't always, but they some did. And it ran into issues in future years when parties got into disputes and really didn't anticipate, for example, an issue of attorney's fees, and then it came up in the course of the arbitration. So it's a really good policy to think about these issues when you're drafting the arbitration agreement and decide, do you want to give the panel the authority to award attorney's fees? Do you want to give the panel the authority to award interest, and if so, how much? because the interest can vary depending upon the state. It can also vary greatly if you're applying federal prejudgment interest, which is tough.
Which presupposes that a panel is obligated to look to any particular law to determine that when,
exactly.
In fact, they may not unless the contract obligates them to do it.
Exactly, and the panel may just decide on a rate of its own liking.
Yeah.
So, but the way the panels, the way the parties can get the result they want or get the arbitration they want is to take care of those issues at the outset and include provisions dealing with attorney's fees, interest, or other remedies that they think the panel should or should not be able to award.
How, if in any way, are parties addressing that or just precluding the award of punitive or exemplary damages?
Well, that's oftentimes what they're doing, is they're putting in provisions saying that the panelists shall not have the power to award punitive damages. The issue really came to a head 20 years ago with the Mastrobono case coming out of the Supreme Court, and that really awakened parties to the need to address this in their arbitration agreements, because oftentimes the failure to do so leads to unintended consequences for one side or the other.
What are parties' concerns about when a panel may disregard the law versus when it should have to follow the law, and how do they address that at the drafting time?
Well, the traditional way to deal with it was through the honorable engagement and what's called the disengagement clause. The honorable engagement, of course, says that the contract is an honorable engagement between the parties and the panel shall treat it as such, and therefore the panel can ignore a literal reading of the contract at times, although there are even limits on that, as happened in the Third Circuit. The disengagement clause, as it's called, says that the panel does not have to...
Is that like a divorce? Or?
No, it's that the panel doesn't have to follow the rules of law or the rules of evidence or judicial formalities. And the disengagement clause will say that the panel is relieved of all judicial formalities and need not follow the strict rules of law. That's traditionally how, in reinsurance arbitration, the parties have tried to ensure that the panels will apply custom and practice and their own experience as opposed to what a court might say on a particular subject.
Right, and let's say we're dealing now with parties that are used to that universe and are frustrated by it because they think if there's a legal issue that applies, if there's a provision of their direct contract that's being arbitrated or in the reinsurance agreement, and there's judicial authority on that the rule of law ought to apply. And that panels are as equipped as courts to do that many times, but may not be doing that.
Well, the parties are certainly free to include in their arbitration provision a choice of law clause or provide for that somewhere else in the agreement in order to ensure that in order to attempt to ensure that the panel adheres to that, it should be in the arbitration clause. But even the presence of a choice of law clause in the arbitration provision will not ensure that the panels follow that law unless it's made crystal clear that they must follow the law of a particular state and cannot follow something like custom and practice. So at the drafting stage, if the parties truly want the panel to apply only the law of a particular state, they got to say so right up front. That, of course, gets back to the original issue at the outset. Do you go to litigation or do you go to arbitration? Because if you want a particular state's law applied as a judge would apply it, the better option may be to just decide to go to litigation instead of going to arbitration to begin with.
So, Ed, thank you very much. I want to give you one more question because you're the king of sovereign immunity. So just give you a chance if you want to speak for a minute or so on that.
Well, it's an issue that comes up, particularly in international arbitration. I had a number of cases some years ago, where the reinsurers were owned by, in whole or in part, by governments of South American countries, Argentina, Uruguay, and the issue was whether those reinsurers were entitled to sovereign immunity in the arbitration or in the confirmation proceedings afterwards. The general thrust of the law is that in arbitration, sovereign immunity is basically waived in most instances. And in litigation, it's strictly enforced, but if it's a confirmation proceeding, the arbitral conventions, such as the New York Convention or the Inter-American Convention, have provisions, for example, which allow the court to award pre-answer security, even though under the Federal Arbitration Act that would be forbidden. The Federal Sovereign Immunities Act, I misspoke.
Ed, thank you. Thank you, Ed Lindsay, for your insights on arbitrations and arbitration clauses. We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio. This is Scott Seaman thanking all of you for joining us for Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We look forward to speaking with you soon on other topics of interest to insurance, reinsurance professionals, practitioners, and decision makers.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends. Be a McDonald's breakfast person and get a bagel sandwich. Imagine a fluffy egg, two slices of cheese, plus your choice of a steak patty, bacon, or sausage, all on a toasted bagel. Bagels are here at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.